Hello everyone and welcome to Inside the Arena podcast, brought to you by Piers Arena. On Inside the Arena podcast, we talk about mental health, well-being, and every other issues and challenges we all face in our day-to-day lives. And on each episode, we'll be having a guest on to talk about their own experience with these issues, and most importantly, how they are able to navigate and overcome life struggles and challenges. I am your host, Tony, and thank you very much for listening. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Inside the Arena podcast. Joining us in today's episode is Chima Asonye, founder of Nigerian Mental Health, an organization dedicated to improving mental health in Nigeria. Chima's passion and drive for mental health advocacy has led him to make significant impact in the field. We're also excited to learn more about his journey and the important work being done by Nigerian Mental Health. In this episode, we'll be discussing Chima's inspiring story, the founding of Nigerian Mental Health, challenges being faced, the recent passage of the Mental Health Act, his organization's 10-point agenda relating to the Mental Health Act, and ongoing initiative like Suicide Not a Crime NG. We'll also be exploring the importance of collaboration and the progress being made in raising awareness for mental health issues in Nigeria. And most importantly, how individuals can actually help in this cause. So without wasting so much of our time, I'd just like him to properly introduce himself so we can get a sense of who he is.
Sure. My name is Chima Asonye. I'm a development practitioner. I'm a lawyer. I'm a mental health advocate. I've been working in the field of development, especially focused on frontier challenges on the continent of Africa for the last 15 years. And through that, my work has been cross-cutting. It started in Washington, D.C., working in Capitol Hill and on democratic governance issues. It's spanned to and U.S.-Africa foreign policy. It's gotten more narrowed to be specific on the continent and working in the field, as people may say, on things like in the presidency, advancing the Millennium Development Goals, and also doing that at the subnational level, working as an advisor to governor of Abia State on the Sustainable Development Goals. And then it has gone more regional. I've worked in organizations like PIN, which is Partnership Initiatives from the Niger Delta, focus on advancing peace-building economic development in the Niger Delta region, working especially with government partners at the subnational and the federal level, and then working on other projects with the UK government and US government, focus on things like COVID response, public health. And mental health has always been a passion for me for a very long time. And it's been great working on this space in this nascent area. People are working on mental health, but a lot of Nigeria has a lot of challenges. And so there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. But given your background and the things you've done and the things you're still working on, I was particularly interested to actually know what really motivated you to come back to Nigeria, be in the field, like you said, and like just to get things done.
Well, I mean, I think that the reasons I came to Nigeria are that I'm a lot about action and not talk. And when I was in America, I ran something called Niger DC, which is Nigerian Diaspora Connect. And one of the reasons I founded it was we had a lot of people working in the African space, or at least interested on the continent, but we weren't visible in America. We weren't visible. We weren't the people calling the shots. We weren't the people at the helm of program making. And I felt like it was important for us to share knowledge, information, and opportunities with each other. So I would see some of the same people at the embassies or some meetings. And I said, it's good for us to know what's going on, to share information. And the thing about when you connect individuals who are vibrant, who are smart, who are passionate, you catalyze information into advocacy. So people want to start seeing what they can do and how they can help in small and large ways. And so that's how a lot of my interest in growth on the continent. I was always interested in Africa. You know, my first position coming out of university was working on the subcommittee on Africa and global health. So I was in a place where I was meeting leaders, heads. They would all visit Capitol Hill. And my idea at the time was kind of this idealized vision of if you're working in the premier democracy in the world, you'll learn best practices that you can export elsewhere. And, you know, a lot of the challenges we think about on the continent is that, you know, we have a lot of strong men, we don't have a lot of strong institutions. So that was the idea. Learn best practices in Washington, D.C., export those lessons learned to the continent and see what we can do. I don't feel exactly the same way, like that's the issue per se. I don't necessarily think that all of Nigeria's challenges are just institutional. There's a lot of, you know, there's macroeconomic policy, there's morals and challenges, there's issues of project implementation, none of which that are just institutional, but are sums about capacity, et cetera. So I have a more nuanced understanding of what the challenges were. But when I found myself at the front seat at some of these really challenging issues facing the continent and Nigeria, I wanted to do something about it. I didn't want to just be a cog in the wheel. I wanted to be the one helping push that wheel. And that meant being in the field. I didn't want to be the one that was a development partner supporting partners on the ground. I wanted to be the partner on the ground that development partners were supporting. And at that time was kind of the election of the youth. If you remember back in 2011, we had new democratic reforms in the context of like JEGA being appointed. We had the birth of things like Enough is Enough. We had the RSVP, mm-hmm. Protect Your Vote campaign, et cetera. So a lot of young people and social media were galvanizing into the democratic and electoral space. I was doing some democratic, some advocacy from the diaspora, getting people engaged, you know, Occupy Nigeria. There was a lot of things going on to kind of get people and get Pan-African and Pan-Nigerian advocacy going on the continent. And I was really motivated by a lot of these things and felt that it was a time to not just talk about it from Washington, D.C., being seduced by someone like the democratic ethos that comes from, you know, the White House and things like that, but instead take that fight directly onto the ground in Nigeria. So that's how I ended up moving during that kind of very seminal time. And it wasn't just Occupy Nigeria, and it wasn't just the elections. It was things like global music movements, like the Arab Spring were happening. So there was a lot of activism, a lot of belief that we could really fundamentally change the fundamental kind of structures in place in at home and abroad. So that's what led me to the country. And I was really fortunate that using my connections from Washington, D.C., one of the first positions I got was working in the presidency under Amina Mohammed and in the office of the Senior Special Assistant to the President on the Millennium Development Goals. And we all know how committed Amina is in terms of an advocate and champion. And at the time when I was in Washington, D.C., I felt like she was our version of Hillary Clinton. So I wanted to go work for her. And so it was a really good kind of initial lessons about, you know, what you need to have in place and how, what kind of like framework and infrastructure and vision in order to make real change at the end of the day.
Yeah. And prior to that time of you making that decision to fully move back to Nigeria, did you visit constantly?
Yeah, I was. I mean, I'm Niger. I've been coming back to. I was born in Chicago, but I've been coming back to Nigeria ever since I was young. I would come back, you know, essentially yearly or every other year. I would come to Nigeria. I did internships, things here, but my first full time work experience was in 2011 when I made the decision to fully commit to moving back. I finished university. I had done a couple of years working in Washington, D.C., and then I decided to take my work and my experience to see how I could push advocacy. But I've been coming back here ever since I was young. My dad lived in Nigeria, so it was always home.
Yeah, that's nice. So looking back at 2011 up until this moment, how would you say that decision has aged for you personally?
That's a good question. I think it was great. I think I've been able to meet a lot of the, you know, like when I first landed to Nigeria, you know, one of the first people that some of the people I met are the people who are making things happen today, right? You know, whether it was Amara, who's, you know, one of the heads at the Iradro Center, or where is it Samson Itoto, who it helped, you know, get, and Cynthia, who helped get the Not Too Young to Run bill past, or Chudi with the with Chudi here, or Aisha Aga, who's a photographer who works now with the minister or the former minister of planning and budget. I think that working in the democratic governance space, good governance space, I was really able to meet a lot of the actors, and today a lot of them are heading their organizations, their leadings. We're able to support each other reciprocally on projects. So I think that it's aged well. I think that even, the time that I really entered the mental health space in Nigeria, even though I've been passionate about the subject for a long time, I've been fortunate to been a part of pushing mental health reforms, which had never happened before. And they've been trying to be advanced for over 20, 30 years with no luck. And so I've been fortunate to help be here where there's really a societal shift because of things like COVID to recognize the importance of psychological vulnerability. So I think that those have been really good. I think it's also been, and there's been other shifts too. I think that there's been a large perhaps with the election in 2015, I think there's been more of a focus on subnational governance. And I think, rightly so, things like a recession have reduced domestic budgets at the state level. There's been a rise of actors, whether it's Rotimi Amaechi or, Al-Rufai and things like that, that happened when I transitioned here, that made a much more primary focus on local governance, which I think is important. With World Bank funding and things like that, procurement reform. So I feel like I've gotten here at a kind of a strategic period. And even now we're talking about the fact that there was or are a compelling third force. These are conversations we haven't had today. Or even things that we've been murmuring for a long time, whether it's past the petroleum industry bill or getting rid of the fuel subsidy, right? Or unifying the exchange rates. All these things are really novel, things we've been talking about for decades. So I think that has been a unique moment of time. I don't think it's been really that great on my pocketbook, to be fair. Since I got here, in the year I got here, my salary reduced by half. And it was already paltry at that. And you can just see that increasing, whether it's through hyperinflation now or the fact that the exchange unification has also reduced the value of the naira, and global recessions, the Russia-Ukraine war. So that has been hard and challenging. The removal of the fuel subsidy, those are real world impacts that have impacted individuals, especially in the development space. We're not getting any special finances from anywhere. And then you have to really make the case to development partners about why capacity and human capacity is important to make sure these projects work. And sometimes it's not an argument you win. They have their, they have their rationale from Geneva or DC or Copenhagen or London. And those agendas are not necessarily tied to those of us who are on the ground, who are working on these issues every day. I think that, one of the things that has been good between things like Occupy Nigeria and NSARS is that we're thinking a lot more about resilience, coalitions, mm-hmm. networks, who's at the table, what needs to be supplanted. It's not just about advocacy for advocacy's sake, but trying to have an entire gamut of well-being. Whether it's human rights defenders and lawyers, right, or finances, or psychological well-being and counseling available. So I think there's a lot more focus on resilience, a lot more focus on African agency, even in when you hear presidential actors talk, whether it's at, a president of Kenya talking at the UN Security Council about how the UN Council needs to be reformed, or it's the president of Ghana talking with other heads of the G7, et cetera, about how it's not business as usual. We need more African resilience. We need less dependency on aid, but more partnerships and investment. So we, as individuals, as a people, as Africans, are a lot more, have a lot more focus on our personal resilience, our own agency, that wasn't always the case. But I've seen that demonstrated even within Nigerian Mental Health. And that's the kind of vision that we want to push for our African agency and Nigerian agency in the future.
Yeah, amen. I completely agree with that. I think now more than ever, our generation actually feel we can actually make change. Like it's possible if we stay consistent and we actually believe in the things we're fighting for. So yeah, that's a very big plus. So now coming back to the mental health space, I'm always very, very particular to, I know my reasons why I found myself in this space today, right? I personally had an experience of losing my mom and how that affected me and get being able to overcome that and the process it took me. Then I realized that there are so many people actually going through that same process. And I felt like if there's anything I could do at all to help, and that was what brought me to this space where I am today. But I wanted to ask, where does your passion for your advocacy around mental health come from?
I've always been passionate in the public sector. I think that the sacred public institutions have sacred responsibilities to respond to citizens in ways that improve their lives. And so I studied philosophy and political science. And so when you think about psychology, you might think of the study of like the brain and emotion and individuals and how they think and act and behave. I think that when you think of philosophy, it's kind of the same ethos in the context of the everyday of society, if that makes sense. So I was always kind of been interested in kind of how does the dynamics, the orientations, the thought process, the assumptions behind society works. So those have been questions, and those are questions that were really instilled with me, especially in policy debate. So I would debate, I would argue, and the arguments weren't just about economic and social issues, but they're about philosophical issues, about how we speak about things, about how we think about things, about how we represent things. And that those representations, that discourse also plays a part in how we actually implement and act on things. And so I've always kind of been interested in how is it that spaces, places, institutions impact how we feel, how we think, and how we relate to the world. And so in one sense, those issues and questions are questions that are answered by mental health, right? If we think about the character of an ideal politician, there was a study done, a poll recently done in America, and it said that what do people really want to hear in terms of what their ideal politician would be? And they said things like truthfulness and character and honesty. Those are questions that are answered in the mental health field in terms of vulnerability and character, in terms of empathy. That was the other one, was empathy, right? And vulnerability. Those are questions that are answered or addressed or thought or reflected in when you go to a therapeutic session, or when you think about opening up in a support group, where you think about thinking about considering other people's struggles and challenges, right? So I think that those questions about what the ideal public servant looked like, what the ideal society looked like in terms of society, in terms of reflection, I think what those were part of the initial conversations. I don't think you can think about ideal public service without addressing what it means to be a good public servant and what society should look like. And that really means addresses questions of connection. And I think that that's what we're trying to do with things like, you know, when you're depressed, you don't feel connected to the other individuals. So I think that mental health helps answer those kind of political questions. The second thing is that it's something that's deeply personal in terms of my family. I have immediate family members that are impacted by mental health issues and challenges. It's been something that's plagued different members of my family generally. So that's always been something very personal to me in terms of them taking drugs and them being diagnosed and I going through my own personal mental health challenges and going through therapy and things like that in the past. So I think that that's the second thing in terms of the personal impact. And then I think the third is really just the macro, the macro conditions of living as a Nigerian. Living in Nigeria is challenge, is frustrating. If you're in Lagos, it might be the roads and the traffic. If you're in River State, it might be the air and the pollute. If you're in Abuja, it might be the violence, the insecurity, or people, or the prisons break. If you're in Nigeria, it might be the inflation. There's a study talking about, in I believe it's 2020, from MANI, which is Mentally Aware Nigerian Initiative and Africa Public Institute says that almost three quarters of Nigerians are facing acute levels of stress. So just being a Nigerian, living in Nigeria, is something that will cause psychological vulnerabilities. And so it's one of those things where when I was impacted by this right before COVID, and I'm looking for resources, I don't know where to go. Like, where does one, I used to go to therapy in America. Where does one go to a therapist here? Where are the recommendations? Are there hotlines? And I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to see. I didn't know where I could find resources. And because I couldn't find any of those resources, I felt like it was incumbent on me to really investigate the space, really understand what the issues and challenge are, who are the main players in, because I approached it as kind of a public policy question. And as a public policy practitioner, what do we do? You know, we want to do our desk research to figure out what are the best, you know, what is the information, what's the data on the ground. We want to do our stakeholder mapping to figure out what exactly is going on. So I kind of approached the question of mental health as a public policy practitioner to figure out what was going on when I was looking for resources to help with coping and healing myself.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Understanding the landscape. You said something really, really profound about how institutions work and how everything is all related back to mental health. I think one of the things that we mostly overlook is offices, spaces, institutions are occupied by individuals, and the mental state of those individuals and the well-being of those individuals actually affects the policies that is being put out to the public. So looking at it from that holistic point, I think is very, very, very important. So always realize that the president, your senator, your local government chairman, if they are empathetic, like you rightly said, if they are vulnerable, if they understand, if they are in touch and in tune with their feelings and their mental health, that gives them, that breeds empathy into them to actually realize that every individual is going through the same thing. And maybe that humanity can help curb some of the, personal and issues we have when it comes to governance in our country. So
I think you said two things that were key there. And I want to take them in turn because I think they're important to highlight. The first thing is that the institutions are not just made up of walls, but they're made up of people. They're made up of spaces. They're made up of how you interact with those environments. And what does that mean? That means that those spaces, those places, those environments are part of making up the environment, making up the ethos, making up the mission, framework, vision of how a space operates, even making people feel attuned and welcome. So let me give you an example of this, right? You're a person with a disability. You want to access the government services, but there's no elevator. There's no sign language interpreters. If you have a crisis, there's no psychological support, right? You can't access those social services. So that means that the very space and place issues maintains a dichotomy, a challenge, and a barrier for you to access the public service, right? You go to a individual and you need a sign language interpreter, and they think you're stupid and dumb because and they don't want to attend to you because they don't have the language. And it's not that you're stupid or dumb, how persons with disability have historically been categorized. It's just that you have a communication barrier, you use sign language, they don't know, and they haven't been taught, right, those things, but they represent you as dumb. So it's not a question of policy. This is a question of human understanding, ability to engage and empathize with somebody's situation. So the way you represent them as stupid, idle, and dumb, and want to castigate and diminish them has prevented you providing them services. And it's not a policy at all. It's just an issue of your training, your orientation, and how you think of those who have disabilities. So you can do things to enhance your space, right? You can do things like the posters you have in your room can help in terms of whether it's a black or white wall, if it's an inviting yellow space, if it has paintings and portraits, if it has beautiful painting and portraits and it has aesthetically pleasing, people want to, it feels inviting, it feels welcoming. What if it has pictures of the diverse people who engage in that space, persons with disabilities, young people, women, then it looks like that's a space that's inviting to the community and marginalized communities versus just having the presidents on the wall looking down at you, not smiling, right? Those figures of authority versus being inviting help herald a certain vision of what's important in a space, right? So those environments are specific, and some people are learning those lessons within Nigerian mental health. We have an organization called Tao, for instance, and they are going to mental health facilities and they're painting and beautifying those spaces and saying that because those spaces are beautified and painting, it's a better healing environment for those who are in mental health facilities. So that space, that recognition of that space is actually provides a healing element that's really, really key. The second thing that's key is that how do you inculcate good ethos of empathy and character and truthfulness? This is a question that we don't often face when it comes to policy. But when I was debating, we would ask that question because we can wish a lot of things on the world, right? We can do a training, but how do we inculcate the type of ethos that we want? And the things within mental health, I think, helps inculcate. It gives us tools to inculcate the things. What are the questions that we ask when someone's suffering and you need to know what the issue is and how you can intervene? How do you get them to open up, right? How do you deal with their crisis, immediate crisis, after a social challenge, whether it's, a flood or a terrorist outbreak? What do you do? What do you say with them? How do you help them heal? How do you understand their struggle? So mental health helps give us the tools to think through those kind of questions of first response and suicidal ideations and empathy and making somebody feel comfortable to open up to you. And that's what we need to be encouraging, those tools, so people can really adopt the practices that help them intervene in other people's lives. So I'm not perfect. And so I wanted to, this is kind of a learning practice for me to help develop the tools as an ideal public servant, or just an ideal individual in the person in my everyday and in my political life.
Yeah, that's, I completely agree with that. I know I say that a lot, but that's just the truth. Looking at what you said initially about the spaces and how those spaces need to be well taken care of and inviting and pleasing. And so when people go into those spaces, they can feel relaxed. I have an uncle who has this superstition, right? It's funny, but it's really not. He says whenever he goes to any hospital and they don't have flowers, or they have a flower outside of the hospital and is not well taken care of or whatnot, he said he's not going to get treated there. He's not just going to get treated, because if you can't take care of the life around you, how are you going to take care of my life? I know it sounds stupid when you think about it, but it's not. It's not. People need to think about, put those kind of things in perspective and see how they can actually make environment. Because sometimes you go into said hospitals and it feels like your stress goes up a notch because of the way the place is, because of the stress around the environment and the fact that medical professionals are not, have not been trained when it comes to the mental health of patients or people who come in for their services. I spoke to Dr. Onedikachi. He's the founder of Postpartum Africa. He was talking about how they go around hospitals, you know, training the staffs about, especially nurses, about mental health and what postpartum is and how they need to pay more attention to women who are pregnant and the rest of it, before they give birth and afterwards. So yeah, those are the kind of things that needs to be constantly talked about, so we can understand from an institutional level how real impacts can be made. Even sometimes when you go to the bank, like the way the security guards treat you, like the way the staffs there also treat you. I don't blame them sometimes, because they are often stressed and they don't. Like, it's a lot that needs to be talked about. It needs to be a holistic conversation. I always say this, like, we need to put everything on the table and start taking it apart bit by bit. And you are absolutely right when you say mental health holds one of the most important key to solving these issues when we look at it from that human perspective. So yeah, that's why I say I completely agree with that. You talked about some of the reasons why you founded Nigerian Mental Health, and the timing, it was around 2020, right? You said during COVID.
2019.
So I think one of the questions I wanted to ask is, personally, what would you say are the organization's main goals and objective?
Nigerian Mental Health is a global community of mental health practitioners. We have over 30 organizations as members, actively leading efforts around psychosocial well-being. We are founded in 2019 to really connect people in Nigerian diaspora to strain Nigerian mental health programming through community practice, our WhatsApp group, and other networking events. We have four primary objectives. One is connecting Nigerians actively focused on advancing mental health. So that can be, you know, we have, you know, two or three organizations in the diaspora, but many of our organizations are here and giving us conversation, giving us collective. And I think one of the best thing that happened from the our advocacy for the Mental Health Act was really making sure that we have different professional organizations and voice brought to the forefront, because you know, the mental health space in Nigeria has really been dominated by psychiatrists. Not to say that's bad or anything like that, but just to say that other people also need to be part of the conversation. And we know, whether it's you know, psychiatric nurses or social workers or occupational therapists or pharmacists, or you know, the list, lay counselors, human rights activists, lawyers, right? Traditional and faith leaders, they are part of the mental health conversation. So trying to bring these actors together. And through our work, we've been able to get on two occasions for supporting passage of the Mental Health Act with the presidency, over 40 organizations, including the four leading mental health organizations, to support that. And then other efforts like our 10-point agenda that I'm sure we'll get into. We had over 40 organizations sign up to that. So how do we connect these actors and give voice to them in the mental health space? Or not give voice, amplify their voices. The second objective is amplifying and training members' efforts on mental health related issues. And that could be on anything. So for me, I used to debate in high school and college, and one of our members was having a debate about different frameworks for how you should approach mental health interventions, one being biomedical and the other psychosocial. So I used my debate background and I chaired the debate. But we have other individuals who require special expertise in autism, and they look within the network, or somebody is having, know somebody is going on a suicidal episode. So they can find specific expertise within the network to help support their programming or individual end user needs. The third is increasing awareness and knowledge and resources focused on Nigeria, Pan-Africa, and dialogue, diaspora mental health. There's so many errors or issues or challenge when it comes to the mental health space, though it's one of the most cited areas of authority within Africa and definitely within Nigeria, one of the most quoted authorities within mental health. But we have a paucity of data and information. You know, our data is really two decades old, unfortunately. So how do we get best practices information into the hands of individuals so they can incorporate a program and help support the ecosystem in terms of those who are really impacted by these challenges? And then finally, conducting programming focused on transformational and sustainable change in Nigeria's mental health landscape. If you have an issue, you should be able to, if you have great people, right, you should be able to come together and do things that are great, that are transformative, but not just transformative and they stop, but sustainable. So we've been pushing a lot of a big, bold initiative, first of its kind efforts, like, you know, our policy advocacy efforts surrounding suicide prevention and the National Mental Health Act that we're helping lead at the federal and subnational level, or our information and evidence, which is another one of our programs, what I call our learning agenda, trying to do social media change, behavior change, trying to do research of and scoping of what is actually going on in Nigeria's mental health landscape, trying to have conversations and debates on some of the key issues within Nigeria's mental health landscape, and cascade those best practices, whether it's from how people have dealt when people have gone public with their issues with a specific organization in terms of their psychological support, or on crisis hotlines. What are best practices? What are things that people need to know and do? And then things like curriculum form. And then finally, our final area of programming from policy advocacy, data and information is wellness. As someone who's really a development practitioner in the forefront, or a social development kind of entrepreneur, I'm really concerned about access. And we know that it's hard to access quality mental health services, either because you can't afford them, you can't find them, you can't get recommendations, or people don't have trust in those institutions, and they have more trust in their traditional institutions, which is nothing wrong per se, like faith, or traditional, other traditional, you know, chiefs and things like that, where people will go through for the challenges when they really may need more specialized clinical services in order to respond. So how do you help people who have those access challenges? And our wellness pillar is supposed to respond to that. We do things like community healing workshops, which are events based on different types of enrichment, often more accessible, where you find enrichment and coping and healing within the body. Things like, you know, affirmations and art yoga and semantic therapy and dance, et cetera, that could help with healing and coping and support your self-care. And we have things, we have a safe spaces where we have individuals who can, which are facilitated peer-centered therapy circles, which are personal and discuss their people's challenges with the kind of vulnerability and respect that's necessary. And then we have finally, as part of that wellness practice, an immersive conference, which is, we hope to happen in October, first of a kind on a continent. It's going to be a forum for education and experimental mental health activities, really utilizing technology to help simulate what it means to live as a person with a disability or with a mental health condition. And also do wellness practices to the larger public versus the more smaller intimate community healing sessions. And then also to co-create different ideas around mental health interventions. Because the thing is that people don't really even know what it means to have a mental health intervention. You know, what most people think of is you go to a facility and you're drugged, or you go to a facility and you're chained because the people who have mental health challenges are crazy and they talk to themselves and they're running around naked and they're trying to stab and kill people. And that, you know, that's actually what the polling suggests. So can we have a contest where we actually share these are what best practices look like and then support them in a pitch competition? So that's geared for October, and I hope some of your listeners, you know, they follow us on our social media, Nigerian Mental Health. We're on everywhere on Nigerian Mental Health, and on Twitter on Nigerian MH. Or they can follow me, Chime Asonye. I'm Chime Asonye on all social media platforms. And by following us, you can stay tuned to our different programmings, our different activities, including our immersive conference coming up in October.
Yeah. I would definitely spread the word. You can even share flyers with me. I'll put it up on our pages across all social media. I always reference the good work you guys are doing. I recently put out a podcast I have with Jenny Okolo. She works with the NSH in the UK. She works in prisons and in hospitals. And we talked about the intersection between mental health and the criminal justice system. And I also talked about, when we're talking about the specific issues and challenges facing Nigeria, we talked about Suicide Not a Crime NG. And even the video I put up on YouTube, the link to signing of the petition is also there. I put it up, attached it to. I'm always very, very interested in sharing resources and just putting out those things out to the world anytime I get the opportunity to. Yeah. Anytime I get the opportunity to. We're in this fight together. I always say it. And the goal is to create.
Look, if you say we're in this fight together, I'm going to keep on calling to you.
Sorry.
Yeah, if you say we're in this fight together, I'm going to keep on calling on you, because I'm the type of person that, you know, we need a lot of people to continue to fight. So, and it's a long fight and it's a sustained fight. But if we do it together, we can do some damage.
Yeah, I totally believe that. So moving forward, you talked about the passage of the Mental Health Act. There's a two-part questions I want to ask. First things first, can you take us behind the scene of how that whole thing came together? Like, I know it was a lot of work, and how that happened. And I also wanted to, like, what was your first reaction when you found out that the president actually signed the act?
I was elated. This is something we'd worked on for a long time. This is something that Nigeria has never had. We're a minority of countries on the continent that have mental health reforms. And so it was really a great experience. It was elation. And I don't think that, you know, my parents, they don't really, I think when you get to a certain age, there's nothing that you do that really they clap for, unless you're getting married and having kids. That's all they, you know, if you tell them, Or maybe you buy them a car, they'll be happy or something like that. Buy them a house. But outside of that, there's not a lot of things I do that they clap for. But this one that they, you know, that we had an event and we celebrated and things like that. They're really, so really, really excited. It wasn't surprising to me that the president ultimately signed it because we hadn't got it this far before. The president, Buhari, actually, you know, whereas he might have has had his challenges, frankly, in a number of areas of reform, I think that in terms of disability advocacy, he's actually done very well. You know, 4 years ago, almost to the day, he passed the Anti-Discrimination Against Persons with Disability Act, which also brought about things like the National Commission on Persons with Disabilities. His wife has mentioned that he is somebody who was challenged with a mental health condition, that because of his days as a military ruler, he had PTSD. So he appointed an advisor on disability. So I think that in general, he was a champion for mental health reforms, and his family is a champion for mental health reforms. And so it wasn't a surprise that he passed it once we got to a certain point, and once finally the bill was sent to the president, which is something which was a historic feat that we'd faced. So it was elated, but I think I might have felt a little bit different than others. A lot of people were happy, but I knew some of the challenges with the bill, you know what I mean, in terms of the lack of voices that were there. But I knew that you know, from my debate days, that passing an act, how many acts have we had passed in Nigeria and they've just sat on the shelf, right? The real work is not the acts getting passed, and it's a historic achievement and it's great. But you know, in my debate days, we would have a card, a piece of evidence that said that 90% of policymaking is in enforcement and implementation. So it used to quantify the fact that a majority, a super majority, a super, super duper majority was in implementation. So, you know, I kind of felt like, great. We give ourselves an applause, but now is a real work of getting those things like a Department of Mental Health or a Mental Health Assessment Committee or a Mental Health Fund passed. And some of those things weren't, how they are going to operate weren't stipulated in the act. So there's a lot of work in terms of objectives, in terms of efforts. And so one of the things we did was, On our website, we have a tab focused on the act, and we have recommendations from that were passed during public service or were submitted during the public hearing. And so we're looking at all those, and people can go. We have, and they can, if they submitted any recommendation to public hearing, they can reach out to us and we'll add it to our website. But we're looking through all those recommendations, because all those recommendations, not all of it had made it into the act. And so we can look at it and see how we can mainstream some of those suggestions in the Mental Health Act going forward. So I kind of felt like I was elated. I was gratified, wasn't surprised, but I felt like now the real work starts in terms of implementing the act. And then just in terms of like the history of the act, like it dates back. I believe that it dated back to like the early 2000s, but I was told actually that it dates back to like the 1972. There are people that are pushing mental health reforms. And so you had, you know, in early 2000s, people pushed for it. It lingered in the National Assembly. It was withdrawn. You know, 6 years later, again in 2013, there was attempts. It failed again, and then in 2019, we find the version that finally ended up going. And there was a lot of challenges in the initial version. And I wrote about this, for instance, in Harvard Africa Policy Review, in a piece with Hawa, who's the founder of She Writes Women, and we outlined some of the challenges in the act, from the title of the act to the fact that it had, you know, different things like still allowing sterilization for individuals who have a mental health condition, except for children. You know what I mean? The fact that it didn't have some the key human rights protection. So to see the further iterations incorporate some of those things, I thought was really good, and we are helpful. And so you don't make, so even though it's not a perfect document, you don't make the perfect enemy of the good. And then, you know, I just remember all the campaigns we did, from the demonstrations to the social media campaigns, to the petitions, to the open letters, right, to the advocacy visits. So it was a lot of going and appealing and talking to the, you know, the different powers that be. And so I think that the best thing that happened at the conversations is that I think that people saw how robust civil society and different actors were, and that helped shape thinking going forward in terms of the implementation and making sure that those voices continue to be part of the conversation. And it was great, you know, of being in interviews with, you know, the Senate chairman who helped, who's head of the public health, who helped champion this, and him acknowledging the work of Nigeria Mental Health and other partners to get this across the finish line. And so it's been a great pleasure working with different partners to push these advocacy efforts. And I look forward to working with them in the future to see how much more we can get done.
Hey, amen. So one of the things you talked about, the challenges or the enforcement challenges that is faced with every act that has been signed anywhere in the world. But I want to ask some questions about, or like a question about that. But before we actually get there, I think the question that needs to precede that is, what is the, if it's done right and the act is being enforced the way it should be, what would be the positive impacts of that bill to the Nigerian mental health space? And then we can now move forward to what are the challenges that we face in enforcing that act, and how, what can we do as individuals, as a society, to make sure we address those challenges and put it at the forefront?
Okay, sure. So what are the positive benefits of the new act? I would say that there's really three or four kind of groups. The first is in terms of the new institutions is created. I've mentioned these before, but let me just reiterate. One, it creates a Department of Mental Health Services, which is really important, that has the power to administer the bill's provisions and really do a lot of the coordination that's necessary to impact the space. It creates a Mental Health Assessment Committee that includes psychiatrists, civil society, community healers, legal practitioners, social workers, supposed to have an appropriate gender balance to enforce the rights of individuals within who are infringed within the Mental Health Act. It also creates a mental health fund. Funding has been a really big challenge for mental health services and for health in general, right? We only have around 5% of our entire budget that's focused on health. And of that 5%, only around 3-4% is focused on mental health. So when we think about it as as we think about the right to health, detailing physical, mental, and social areas, right? It's really the right to mental health has been abridged in when we think of the broader context of health. So there's huge financing challenges. Then in the context of human rights, the bill does things like it gives rights in certain social sectors, so like lack of discrimination for housing, employment, legal, and medical services. It prevents individuals it allows individuals to be able to express themselves in care. You had a lot of individuals who would just be treated on. They wouldn't have their information. They wouldn't be getting any information or access to their opinions. This changes the hopes their right to express themselves, to share their opinions, have right to access information on their treatment. It allows individuals who if they can't exercise their rights when it comes to their treatment, they can have a legal representative help them in formulating their treatment plan. And then in care, it does things like making sure that the mental health services are integrated at all levels in all health levels and public facilities, which is really key because that gets us to some of our community mental health components, making sure that mental health gets to the grassroots. It makes sure that we think about mental health integrated in other disease programs because mental health is something that is comorbid. It is something that is challenged when you're thinking about HIV AIDS or reproductive health or someone who, or postpartum depression, right? So we need to integrate mental health services in other disease specific programming. It helps incorporate those with lived experience within the treatment and the support of those who have mental health conditions, because we need to think about one-to-one, and people's lived experience is an important testimony of how you can deal and cope with mental health challenges in general. And it makes sure that there's no treatment without prior written consent, which is really, really key. It's supposed to, in terms of managing mental health, I think finally, this is really key. It helps training and capacity building of those who are dealing with mental health services and individuals, so they can de-escalate conflict. If somebody's triggered, or they're having an episode, or they're having a challenge, or they're acting a bit robustly, and they can potentially cause physical violence, it gives people the tools in terms of de-escalating those crises instead of just beating them and things like that that happened in the past. It bans forced seclusion and other methods of restraint, because, like, you know, people would chain, they would drug, they would have different chemical restraints. It bans all of those things, which I think is really key. It prevents sterilization, which I mentioned before. And this can't be overemphasized, because the idea behind sterilization is the idea that certain genes should not continue. And so those who have mental health conditions should be sterilized, because we don't want their genes, they're defective and they're devalued, and we don't want them to contaminate future gene pools because they're not worthy of having kids. So early stipulations of the Mental Health Act actually had sterilization of adults, and it just tried to exclude it for kids because they thought that there was a special category. But the idea is this eugenic fantasy of what the ideal able body looks like. It prevents things like sterilization and teaching without following proper guidance, like the National Health Act or the National Code for Health Research Ethics. And then finally, it bans, it has really high penalties for those who are caregivers if they're caught doing any sexual abuse or misconduct for individuals. It gives individuals like a life in prison, imprisonment if they're caught. So there shouldn't be the sexual exploitation of those who have mental health conditions. And so those are some of the major stipulations and rights. And in terms of enforcement, I think that there's a lot that can be said there. I think part of this is some of the things we said in our mental health 10-point agenda, which I can kind of describe now. The first thing is you can't, and I'll just kind of try to go through the 10 points because I think that they're key in the context of enforcement. Yeah. You can't enforce rights that people are not aware of. So the first thing is people need to be aware of their fundamental rights. And so that means that making sure that there's a publicly accessible gazetted mental health act. Right now we have the gazetted mental health act on our act, but people need access to it on trusted government mental health government websites. So that means the Federal Ministry of Health, the National Assembly. If people can't access it, they don't know what the new terrain of rights are, right? So they can't have civil society uphold what the actions and the implementation and provisions of the act are supposed to be. So first, a publicly accessible gazetted mental health act on trusted mental health services. Second is our Suicide Not Crime NG, which is decriminalizing attempted suicide. We have, you mentioned it earlier, but essentially the World Health Organization says that if we have people, right now attempted suicide is a crime, according to our criminal penal code. The World Health Organization says that people do not want to share their suicide ideations, their challenges. We don't have doctors who want to share information about their patients, about suicide cases, et cetera. So we get less data, and people don't want to share the psychological vulnerability. And the very point of the Mental Health Act is to get people the help they need. So we can't have other regulations that contravene, right, are counterproductive to that end. So we need to make sure we decriminalize attempted suicide, which is our Suicide Not Crime NG campaign. Individuals can go on our website and sign a petition. We have thousands of people who have already signed, and your voice can help that. The third is that we need the political capital. Without political capital, we wouldn't have gotten the Mental Health Act passed in the first place. And we have a new regime, a new administration. We have the Tinubu for now. We have all the governors at the subnational level. You know, health is a major subnational priority. So we need these new administrations to prioritize whether they're budgeting, their long-term development planning, their medium fiscal term plans, to prioritize mental health efforts. If we don't have the human capital, the political buy-in, then we won't get the effective implementation of the act, right? Talk self less of you know, implementation at other levels in terms of the objectives, et cetera. The fourth is we need money. you know, we don't have, you can't, if you don't have the finances, you can't have new projects, new programs. You can't finance the important critical, whether it's drugs or psychosocial support that's needed. We have the challenge right now is that we there's not a lot of money, and the money that we have is geared towards psychiatric hospitals and drugs. And we need to do more than that. We don't even have, and mental health care needs to come up with larger increases just in the health budget, because we've committed to the Abuja Accords of having 15% for health budgeting. But like I said, we have around 5%, which is really paltry, and we need to do more. Nothing about us without us is the fifth implementation target, which means that we need folks who are talking about implementing the Mental Health Act who have mental health condition, because they can talk about, and their representative institutions. So we need persons with disabilities, civil society, persons who have mental health conditions to be part of the table. We shouldn't have people legislating on individuals with mental health conditions without incorporating their key voices. Six, we need to include diverse factors in this. So right now there's a psychological bill, which doesn't really make any sense, because that psychological bill, which is pending passage, could have been incorporated in things like the Mental Health Act, right? So how do we make sure that psychologists, lay counselors, lawyers, et cetera, are part of the conversation going forward in the future? We need to uphold all voices in all professional fields, because all of these individuals are key parts of the conversation to support and advance mental health. The seventh is mainstream psychosocial support. We have nearly 100% of the funding for mental health go towards what I would call biomedical, which thinks of mental health as a disease that needs to be just treated with drugs confined, versus psychosocial support, like I said, art, social groups, you know what I mean, radiotherapy, apps, et cetera, that all the different types of things that you can do in terms of mainstreaming psychosocial support. So we need to increase funding for that as a percentage of the mental health budget. We need to define clear metrics of ACT success. So what does it mean that we have a mental health ACT? How do we know we're being effective? We may know we're being effective if we're getting more data when it comes to suicide rates and depression. If we're decreasing, if suicide rates are decreasing, if more people have the ability to, the tools to talk about mental health with individuals who have other types of physical disability, right? So a psychologist, psychiatrist are trained in basic ways that they can engage with individuals, right? More people are trained on first response. So there's a lot of ways we need to define the clear ways to say, in a year or 2 years, this act has been effective and this is why. Or mainstreaming other accommodations that need to happen, whether in electoral services and civic space or public institutions. We need to include mental health in primary health care centers. Right now, you can go to a primary health care center, you can get your malaria test, you can get your typhoid test. You can't get a lot of mental health support, all right? But people who are facing mental health challenges, they're in the grassroots, they're in the rural areas, they're in the last mile. So we need to make sure that we can mainstream mental health services and some basic trainings at that level to people, to provide support for individuals, you know what I mean, who can't access it all over the country. And then finally, we need to make sure that states are on board. We only have two states that have mental health acts. That's Ekiti and Lagos. But we need to domesticate that across the board, across the country. So the 10th and finally is domestication of the Mental Health Act. So states really play a key part in mental health recovery, support, and advancement at the subnational level.
Yeah, all those is very, very, very important. And like always, I would leave links to your website and links to how people can actually read about these things on their own to further educate themselves and also find ways to support what you guys are doing, because it's really, really amazing. And it should be what we are all doing as a society, not just what is left to one organization or to a bunch of organizations. One of the things that is constantly clear when I did research about you and your organization and trying to understand how you operate is the power of collaboration. And that's why I personally felt like, oh, if I reach out to this person, he will be willing to come talk about what he got going on and how we can further move the conversation forward. So, and you talked about how this bill has been trying to pass for years and how you came in. You talked about the 40 other organizations that are brought together in order to promote and push the conversation forward. So I would like you to talk for a moment about the power of collaboration and what we can all achieve as Nigerians if we are able to all come to the table and focus.
We couldn't do anything without our partners. There's a reason why, and I think that there's power in numbers. The power of partnerships is so important. As a matter of fact, when we're doing half our events, you can't even see Nigerian Mental Health First on our flyers. Because we want people to know that this is a coalition of the willing. This is a network of the willing. This is a community of the willing. And that's very, very important to us. If people see the strength in numbers, and so if people see that a lot of people have bought into an idea, they're more willing to connect. And then our partners have brought so many diverse ideas and abilities and to the table. So for instance, when we were doing the demonstration walk, I think our partners helped us make that more psychosocial by bringing like the yoga and the dance and some people doing wellness checks so people can, or even having psychiatrists and psychologists or bringing volunteers to the fold. When through our partnerships, the way we came up with the 10-point agenda was curated after for months long of conversation about what we need to implement the bill. So there was a lot of things that partners brought to the fore. And I think that the thing about why Nigerian Mental Health was created in the first place was because a lot of people, we need that spiritual energy in order to continue pushing collectively. Mental health is one of those places where it's hard to know if you're making an impact. It's hard to understand. It's hard to keep going because there's not a lot of funding. And so working with others and giving yourselves the spiritual energy to be resilient and to continue pushing is one of the ways that we continue fighting. And just a small antidote, we're working with a development partner, and two, three days before we were going to do an event, they pulled out of the event. They're going to help us. They were one of our fiscal sponsors. And we came together as a network, and we raised over ₦1 million to do the event ourselves. And that's the power in networks. That's the power of resilience. That's the power in agency, where we're not over-reliant on dictates of other partners. We can do things if we come together. We can make a change for ourselves. So our partnerships help with that resilience and help us really galvanize ourselves to really make a difference in the mental health landscape.
Thank you very much for pointing that out. So moving forward, right, as a young person, you chose from a very early age to have impact in your community, direct impact, right? And that was why you focused on community building, capacity, and the rest of the things that you've talked about. How has that fulfilled you on a personal level?
I mean, I think I want to leave a mark on the world, and I really want to leave a mark on what I call home. So I've been kind of thinking about this idea of what is home, what is homemaking, and what is community. And so I think that two of my kind of aligned goals has to do with the idea of making impact at home. And for me, home is Chicago, home is Nigeria, home is Umuahia, home is Aba, home is Abia, home is Umueleri, like my villages, to my town, to my country. With that pan-diasporic idea, but it's also building community, you know what I mean? I feel like my happiest times is building networks and communities of practice towards change, and knowing that I'm up with aligned spirits. So it makes me feel happy that I'm in my purpose. So it's been really good to think about what is home and trying to make a difference, and then also building community. So we elevate a lot of voices and people together. And I think that there's nothing more profound than affirming yourself or affirming agency. You know what I mean? Like when somebody's, when you affirm yourself and who you are, I think that there's nothing more profound in terms of your subjective thoughts and desires are affirmed in the world. And so that's what I think that agency does. It gives you the ability to affirm yourself within the world. And that's what happens when you build community. You guys can connect with each other to affirm ourselves, our voices, and amplify our visions and ultimately our dreams so we can achieve them.
Yeah, I really agree with that. So what advice do you have for young people who are actually, you know, battling with this whole sense of meaning thing, right? And how they can find a career or find a goal or find that personal sense of I want to walk towards in order for them to have a positive mark or to leave a positive mark in the world?
I would say three things. The first thing is we need less talk and more action. I think that young people, we talk a lot, we dream a lot, we're very unfocused. You need to focus and you need to do. And to do, you need to plan. And you need to incorporate the communities in which you want to invest in or you want to do anything in. You have to have transformative, you have to have sustainable intervention. So like, okay, your thing happens and then what, right? So I think in general, we need to talk less and plan for sustainable impact is the first advice I would give for young people. The second thing is that I think that we need to really situate ourselves in things that cultivate the right ethos for change within us and help cultivate us to give the right tools. So for me, it was debate. You know, I was on the debate team. It taught me, it was the most transformative impact in my life. It taught me to ask the right questions. It told me to communicate, to critically think. It told me to have a clear policy vision for intervention and change. So I couldn't have abstract thoughts. I had to have something very specific that I was going to call and do. So I think that my thing was debate, but other people's thing might be something else. It might be whatever extracurricular that meets you. I think debate is a good one. I think any of the forensics, things that teach around speech. But for you, it might be student government or Model UN or ASAC. Right. I would encourage young people to get involved in something where you do work. You don't just talk about the work. You do the work and you learn by and doing. And then I think the third thing is that people shouldn't be put in boxes. I think that one of the problems we have is that we are in this box. I must be a lawyer. I must be a dentist. I must be an accountant, et cetera. But this world is interdisciplinary. And I think that I'm a shining example of a person who's a lawyer who's working in mental health, and people don't really get it. But to me, if you're a development practitioner and you're concerned with public health, right, and you're concerned with social development, how are you not interested in mental health? It's the defining issue of our time. It adds more people die from suicide than die from war and violent crimes, die from terrorism a year. So if you're somebody who's interested in development contract, when we think about persons with disability, we're one of the largest minority groups, right? And everybody, disability is part of our collective future, whether it's by age or accident or by health, right? Disability is part of our, so we can't not be concerned with public health challenges and not thinking about disability or not thinking about mental health, right? So we should not think of these things in silos, but interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary approaches towards change. If we're not thinking about the way that art, like I think about art and music, I think about music and development, I think about development and other politics, right? In interdisciplinary fashion, I think we need to stop thinking about things in our silos, whether it's law and business, et cetera, like that, and see where the convergences are. Where you can meet those convergences, you'll be much more happy and fulfilled, and you have longer varieties of change that will bring on a broader stakeholder of actors. Because when we think about mental health, like I said, it's not just about psychiatrists, it's about the lawyers, it's about the mental health practitioners, it's about the faith leaders, it's about the lay counselors, you know, it's about the individual, about those who have mental health conditions, right? That multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary actors will bring more to the fold and help those linkages that ultimately carry your goals further in the future.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the things that you said that really, really resonates with me is the fact that young people need to focus on building capacity. just not dreaming but doing, and not just getting their hands dirty, you know, getting in the fight for real. I think that's one of the things I admire most about you. You're talking about moving back to Nigeria and seeing you wanting to be on the ground, you know, and you wanting to be the person that other agencies and other organizations want to work with in order to enact real change on ground. So there's also this question when it comes to building capacity that there's this issue I really want to talk about. This thing, Anujide Oju brought this to my attention about as we're talking about the mental health fights, the awareness as young people are building initiatives and organizations and what they need to be aware of, right? What they need to spend more energy on, because we see sometimes people just say mental health experts, they have no form of mental health training whatsoever, but because it's like a thing, right? It's like something people can associate themselves with or whatnot. So they kind of use that sometimes to kind of gain relevance to themselves or attract attention to themselves. So what do you have to say to that? And have you seen things like that? And what do you really have to say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I 100% agree. I think I think qualifications is important. I think, for instance, I say I'm a mental health practitioner. I don't pretend to be a psychologist or psychiatrist. I'm telling people I'm a lawyer. I think people should know that from the front. Like I talk about how I approach the mental health space as a public policy practitioner. And I bring my unique skill sets to that particular discussion. But that's why you surround yourself or you get expertise in the field. You know, one of the things that we're doing within Nigerian Mental Health is that we have a director of research, Dr. Latifa. She's a professor in America. And we just did a mental health literacy assessment within our organization. And I asked her, you know, where is this literacy assessment coming from? And she said it's from two best practice diagnostic tools that is in the literature, because I don't want to just get assessed from something random. I want it to be tools within the literature. And now what we're doing is that we're using that and we're designing capacity building within our organization to make sure that we're all have the requisite training and understanding, but we did it from a baseline, right? And then we move forward. The same thing is for different types of mental health interventions. There's a lot out there. I can't remember the one that Manny said that they use. That's Manny's Mentally Aware Nigeria Initiative. I thought they were using MGAP, which is one of the ones from the World Health Organization that is encouraged for more resource countries to do mental health interventions. But they're using another one. I think it's something plus. I can't remember. But just learning what their mental health intervention was, that it was evidence-based. And now I'm going to go research it and trying to see, okay, is that a mental health intervention we should adopt that's better than MGAP, et cetera. So I think it's very important to be evidence-based, to see what the information is out there and to apply, because at the end of the day, the end users have their lives on the line. Like what you say, what you share, how you intervene, if you apply a problem-solution approach or a cognitive behavioral approach, right? Or a mental health first aid approach. All of those have implications. And so because of where we are, I think it's very important that we approach this in an evidence-based, rigorous manner. So I would encourage other individuals to do that, to continue to get qualifications. So we can really make sure what we're doing is based on the literature and is helping people who are in real need.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And not to discourage people who want to actually get into the space or who actually feel the need to do something. When I told my friends I was getting into the mental health space, they were laughing like, how? What expertise do you have to offer? And I said, I'm not going into it as like I'm bringing a solution or whatnot. I'm going to try as much as possible to get experts and professionals to come along with that journey, right? If I want to talk about specific issues, I would reach out to people who are experts or who are professionals in that particular field and that space to come give us insight. And I will ask curious questions from my own perspective. And hopefully sometimes I get questions from other people also who may be affected by that particular issue, right? To have their voice out there and to just see how we can learn together as a community. So I encourage more people to get into the space, but I'm just, what you said, understanding that the people at the other side of it, at the end side, are people who have real life issues and we shouldn't do have measures with people's lives or whatever the case is. So yeah, thank you very much for that. So I would like to end on the note with you talked about some of the places people can find Nigeria Mental Health online and your personal social media space, but I would really like you to reiterate again and to say, okay, where can people actually find Mental Health Nigeria, people who want to get involved, like volunteers or whatever, or also to educate themselves about the work you guys are doing? How can people reach out to you, and where can people find you guys online?
Sure. The first place you should go, first of all, thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk about my journey and Nigerian mental health. People can find us first by going to our website, www.nigerianmentalhealth.org. There you can find useful resources. For instance, we have crisis hotlines that you can activate within your particular state or nationally, which is important. We have information on the Mental Health Act. We have information on our Suicide Not a Crime campaign. So you can go there, you can learn about us, stay up to touch, but also act, which is what I would encourage you. If you heard this whole message and you think it's interesting, then help us pass it forward. So please sign our campaign, Suicide Not Crime campaigns, right now, so we can decriminalize attempted suicide. You may have a friend who is having suicidal ideation, and if they were imprisoned, how would you be feeling? So you can add your voice to end that. And you can also do things like reading our policy memo on the subject. It's 15 pages. If you're curious about why we should decriminalize attempted suicide, and going further into the reasons. So please check us out. We're on social media at Nigeria Mental Health on all social media platforms, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, etc. You can follow me personally at Chime Asonye. I'm on Chime Asonye on all platforms as well. Instagram, LinkedIn. I do respond to, this was a message as well. I responded to the message. It took us a while to do this because I was traveling, but in general, I respond to messages that have to do with mental health or pushing the arena. If it's anything more than hi, I usually respond, because I believe that this is, activation for change. And also on our website, you can sign up to volunteer. So I would just give this caveat. I have a lot of people who have reached out about volunteering. And at first, I would just have people volunteer. But I believe in words, not actions. So if you do want to volunteer, how we work now is that we give all volunteers some sort of assignment. It's random. It's not based on anything. We give everybody an assignment. And that basically helps weed out folks who are just like casually interested. Yes, they're interested in mental health. Yes, they want to casually volunteer. But they don't want to roll up their sleeves and do the act work. They just kind of want to show up. It's not about showing up. At this point, we need to do more than just show up. We need to show up and do impact. So that's just a good faith effort of, are you willing to work or not? And so we continue to push and move. So follow us on Nigeria Mental Health. Follow me, Chime Asonye, and sign the petition. And then show up and volunteer. And we look forward to hopefully collaborating with some of your listeners in the future.
Yeah, amen to that. I'll be leaving all the links he mentioned in the description, so people can easily just click on them. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to have this conversation with me. I truly, truly appreciate that. And I'm hoping we can do something like this again in the future. And I'm always here. If there's anything you need me to push forward or anything you just need a collaborative effort on, I'm always here and willing to be on the fight together.
I think what we should talk about in all seriousness is becoming a Nigerian Mental Health member. So hopefully we can have that conversation in the future. And so, like I said, so it's not just something where it's a passing conversation, but building a continued collaboration and community towards impact.
Amen. Just let me know whenever you're ready to do that, and we'll jump right on it. Yeah. Thank you very much, Jimmy. Yeah. Thank you very much for listening to this conversation. To support this podcast, please like, share, leave a comment or a review, and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Piers_Arena. Thank you once more.